This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. My guest this morning is James McWilliams, Ingram Professor of History at Texas State University. James is the author of five previous books on food, animals, and agriculture, including Just Food and A Revolution in Eating. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Harper's, Slate, The Atlantic, The Paris Review Daily, and a wide variety of other publications. James McWilliams is here today to tell us about his most recent book, Modern Savage, Our Unthinking Decision to Eat Animals, published in 2015. Welcome, James.
Hi, thanks for having me.
What is the goal or purpose of your book, Modern Savage?
Well, Americans are overwhelmingly concerned with issues of animal welfare. And the response that they've had to it has largely been to become very critical of industrial animal agriculture, something we hear a lot about in the media today. There are many, many problems with animal welfare as it's practiced on these big factory farms. The purpose of my book is to take this critique a step further and ask questions about welfare practices on small, non-industrial farms. And these farms are often described as being sustainable, as raising humanely raised animal products. They're often local, they're often organic, and there's a wide terminology that's used to kind of indicate that these are different kinds of farms. And the point of my research was to look into these farms and actually ask whether or not the welfare practices were any better or worse on these smaller farms. And largely what I found is that many of the welfare claims, the claims to high standards of animal welfare that are supposed to be happening on these small farms are in fact not happening. So the ultimate purpose of my book was to alert consumers to this reality that in general I think the media does a very poor job of exposing.
In what ways are the current alternatives to factory farming, those small-scale, organic, local, free-range ones, an improvement over factory farming?
There's no question that in many respects they are an improvement. Very often they're more sustainable. They are usually run by people who have broader concerns than just the bottom line. They have concerns about community. They have concerns about the most responsible use of land. They have concerns about the long-term environmental viability of their operation, and they do care about animals. There's no doubt about it. And animals that are truly raised on pasture for the vast majority of their lives, that have access to shelters during inclement weather, are obviously going to be animals that are better off than animals that are crammed into crates indoors in factory farms. So in my book, I don't deny these improvements, and I think it's important to acknowledge them. But what I do challenge the reader to ask is if better is necessarily enough, because even though these farms are often better in many respects, given what has to happen to animals, even on these better farms, for their meat and for cheese and their eggs to wind up on our plate, there's still an enormous amount of suffering that has to take place. And again, as I listen to consumers talk about what they care about when it comes to food, they do care about animal welfare. And even if a farm is better, this does not mean that there still is not considerable suffering happening on those farms.
In your book, you argue that when we buy from small, non-industrial farms, we may actually strengthen industrial agriculture. Would you explain?
I do believe that. It seems like a counterintuitive argument. However, the decision to purchase animal products from small farms is, on the one hand, an affirmation of the act of eating animals. And one of my big arguments that I make, in this book and elsewhere, is that as long as we normalize the act of eating animals and animal products, and look, there's a perfectly good reason why it seems normal. We've done it for most of human history. But as long as we normalize that, it's going to be very difficult for small farms that cannot take advantage of scale economies to ever compete with their industrial counterparts. So when we affirm the act of eating animals, what we are essentially doing is saying, okay, there are going to be more expensive alternatives for those who can afford to indulge in those alternatives, but the vast majority of meat, cheese, and eggs are going to come from the factory farms that concerned consumers know are full of very serious problems. So the kind of takeaway from this argument is that if we really wanted to go after industrial agriculture, the number one most powerful thing we could do would be to stigmatize the very act of eating animals. And this idea came to me not out of the blue. It's an idea that actually came to me from an interview that I did with some executives at Monsanto for a previous book that I was working on. And Monsanto is the largest seed company in the world, often kind of vilified and symbolized as the face of industrial agriculture. I was working on a critique of eating local. And when I asked them at Monsanto if they were worried about this trend about people eating local and kind of dropping out of the industrial food system, they said, no, not in the least. What they worried about, one guy told me, was people not eating animals at all. I mean, that is what really threatened Monsanto. And I think by extension, that's what really threatens industrial agriculture. My book right now is getting more attention from the trade, like the cattle industry and the corn industry, than any other place right now. And I think there's a reason for that. They see my message as a real threat. They don't see small sustainable farms producing animals on a small scale as nearly as much as a threat.
In your book, you say that we need to get emotional about animals if we are to treat them with dignity. Why is this the case?
There's this prevailing belief that if you bring emotion into a discussion about animal welfare, that you're being sentimental, that you're anthropomorphizing. And what I try to argue is that in many areas of life, we are actually initially led by our emotions to come to believe something. And to somehow suggest that there's no room for emotions here, I think, is to deny a really important channel into a system of beliefs about animals that we're denying ourselves. It's very stoic, it's very brave, it's often portrayed as courageous to not be emotional about animals. So I have a chapter in my book about people who do their own slaughtering of the animals that they raise, and they write extensively about it. And one of the themes that repeatedly occurs is this kind of stoicism of not getting emotional about it, of kind of taking this rock-ribbed, unemotional approach to this brutal task of slaughtering an animal. And I don't fully understand that, especially given that the default reaction would be to be emotional. Now, some people are emotional about it, and many of those stop doing what they once thought they wanted to do to animals by raising them and slaughtering them. And so I really believe that if we're going to see any sort of significant change in the way that we treat animals, rather than just paying the issue lip service, to a certain extent we need to be led by our feelings about animals. And, you know, anyone who's lived with a companion animal knows how powerful and real those feelings are. And what I suggest in my book is that we should spend more time trusting those feelings rather than questioning them, or rather than dismissing them as being sappy or sentimental.
Why is there a disconnect between our empathic connection with animals and our willingness to eat them, in your view?
The primary reason for that is we live in a world where we create categories. And very often, those categories can erase whatever kind of emotional or even like perfectly logical reaction we might have to our behavior. Just to give you an example, it's becoming very popular right now for people to eat rabbit. And I even think Whole Foods and maybe in certain parts of the country are starting to sell rabbit. And it's a really interesting case study because rabbit happens to be one of these animals that we both keep as pets and eat. This is generally not true for most farm animals. And of course, we don't eat our cats and dogs, but we create categories. And somehow those categories allow us to be unthinking, which is one of the reasons why the subtitle of my book is Our Unthinking Decision to Eat Animals. We don't eat dog, but we'll eat pigs, we'll eat cows. Well, rabbits are different because some people keep them as pets, some people eat them, and some people do both. And the way this has been resolved, in so far as it's even been discussed, is there's now a category called meat rabbit and a category called pet rabbit. So rather than thinking through the underlying ethical complexity of eating an animal that we also care for as the companion animal, rather than grappling with that, we just create a terminology, and somehow the existence of that category absolves any sort of further thought or discussion about the actual behavior itself.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is James McWilliams, Ingram Professor of History at Texas State University, and author of the book, The Modern Savage, Our Unthinking Decision to Eat Animals. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on listener-powered KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. In what ways does eating animals undermine society?
Well, that's a big question, and I do tackle it to a certain extent in my book, but I think that societies are held together by a basic sense of justice. And the more I look at what we do to animals to get them on our plates, I find injustice. I find unfairness. I find exploitation. I find examples of behaviors that most human beings in other contexts would call barbaric. So given that, I think on some level, the health of a society is based on how forthrightly it deals with basic questions of justice. Another way of putting this is the health of a society is based on its unwillingness, its refusal to obscure suffering. I think our habit of eating animals as voraciously as we do poses a real threat, just as much of a threat as other forms of injustice once posed throughout history. So the effort among animal rights activists to draw attention to what we do to animals is often perceived as being self-righteous or an invasion of personal choice. And, I mean, on the one hand, I can sort of see why people think that. I mean, nobody wants to be told how to eat. It's a very personal, it's a very intimate thing. But I think it's also important to recognize that when I sit down to write a book like The Modern Savage, I'm not doing it to sort of wag my finger and scold people. It actually comes from a much more charitable place, and that is a belief in a society that can be much better, where people treat each other with greater dignity, in part because they have made decisions to treat other species that have feelings with dignity as well. So I think there are really interesting and important connections that we can make between how we treat non-human animals and how we treat each other. And I don't want to over-idealize that, but I don't think it's too much of a leap to see that there is a connection there. So if we have goals of being a fair and just society, it seems sensible to me that we shouldn't kill 10 billion animals a year to eat them.
Let's look now in detail at some of the so-called humane alternatives to factory farming. In what ways does the ideal of a humane chicken farm not match reality?
Well, chickens themselves are animals that grew up in the jungles of Southeast Asia. They need dense thickets in order to feel comfortable because one of their most natural instincts is to fly and perch on low-hanging branches. This is what makes a chicken happy. This is what allows the chicken to be a chicken. Now, it is true that the chickens that we see today on farms are genetically distant from wild jungle fowl, but the behavioral instincts remain largely the same. So it is very easy to watch a chicken move around outside and think that it's a happy chicken, and it's certainly better off than being in a battery cage. I don't want to suggest that it's not. Nonetheless, we have to be very careful about assuming that the chicken is feeling as if that chicken's in a natural environment. Chickens out on an open pasture are going to be nervous because they're worried about hawks, they're worried about predation, and they don't have the kind of natural forest that their wild ancestors had to hide in if a hawk does show up. So what looks to be humane may very well not be. Rates of predation are extremely high amongst people who raise chickens on a small scale. They're high because the chickens are outside and can't engage their natural defense mechanisms, and more often than not, they're very high because the chickens are actually inside of a coop, and a snake can get into the coop, raccoons can get into the coop, and it's just typically a bloodbath. And so one of the more, I think, gruesome and gripping sections of my book actually looks at some of these stories of chicken predation. And obviously, there are farms where it doesn't happen, but all I'm trying to show in my book is that it's extremely common. If you listen to people who are raising chickens, this is probably their number one complaint: chickens getting killed by predators. And as I see it, that's unfair if the chicken doesn't have the opportunity to engage in its natural protective instinct to lock a chicken into a large coop and make it sort of a fish in a barrel for a raccoon. Strikes me as profoundly unfair and just barely better than a battery cage.
How does the mortality of chickens on humane farms compare with industrial agriculture?
There's actually no systematic data to answer that question with any hard evidence, but I have spoken to several agricultural economists who have looked into this question, and their very strong sense, and based on the research that I did and based on numbers and numbers of cases of people losing chickens. The percentage is probably higher on smaller farms than on factory farms. You know, factory farms work very hard to have no more than a 6% rate of losing chickens before slaughtering them. And I think it's very likely. I don't want to say for sure because I don't have any empirical data to back this up. But after talking to ag economists and reading extensively about accounts of people losing chickens, I think it's safe to say that it's probably higher on small chicken farms. I mean, if you've got a flock of 50 birds and a raccoon gets into the coop at night and you lose 10 of them, it's an extremely high rate of loss.
How free from disease are free-range chickens?
Again, there's no systematic evidence on this. The way that I investigated this question was I went into forums where chicken farmers talk about these issues. And next to predation, the number one concern that chicken farmers had to do with disease. If you've got a small flock of birds and one of them has a cough, it's going to make a chicken farmer very nervous because if that disease spreads, yeah, these birds are not packed together, so it won't spread as easily, but they interact a great deal. They're social animals. If that disease spreads, you're looking at a situation where your entire flock of birds has a respiratory infection, and respiratory infections in chickens can easily morph into very serious conditions where the birds die, and sudden death syndrome is really common on all chicken farms, large and small included. And what I found was that a lot of these chicken farmers, once they started to see evidence of a possible sickness spreading amongst their flock, they were very quick to rush for the antibiotics. And I found evidence of a tremendous amount of antibiotic use on small chicken farms. And that runs counter to what we often hear. The factory farms are typically condemned, as they should be, for excessive antibiotic use. But antibiotics are used extensively on small farms as well. I found a couple of accounts of vets chiming in on these chicken forums saying, look, you all have to stop doing this because you're going to create the same problems that factory farms have. When you're keeping an animal in relative confinement, whether it's a coop or in a pasture or in a cage, I mean, when you're keeping an animal for the purposes of turning that animal into food, disease is going to be an ever-present concern, and it's a constant preoccupation for small farmers, which is not to say, and I want to be very clear about this, that some farmers don't have problems with disease, but many do, and I think it's just important to recognize that what really matters is management, and it's often very difficult to keep things so clean that the birds don't get sick.
You are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is James McWilliams, Ingram Professor of History at Texas State University and author of the book, The Modern Savage, Our Unthinking Decision to Eat Animals. How does the slaughter of animals in small-scale operations compare to slaughter in industrial operations?
It's kind of a tricky question to answer because there's some variety here. A lot of smaller farms raising animals on a small scale have to load their animals into a truck and take them to a large slaughterhouse, an industrial slaughterhouse, because if they intend to sell the meat from these animals, with some exceptions having to do with the number of chickens on your farm or the number of chickens that you slaughter, in most cases you have to take your animals to an industrial scale slaughterhouse so the meat can be USDA approved. So that's an issue that consumers should be aware of. When they purchase meat from a small farm, it's very possible that that meat came from an industrial slaughterhouse, and these are possibly the most gruesome places that you can imagine. The turnover rate within them is in some cases 200% in a year. Workers can't stand to be in there. It's dangerous. It's psychologically grueling. It's so fast that the room for error is very high. Animals are abused frequently in slaughterhouses. And so when you buy humane, quote-unquote humane animal products, you know, it's very likely that these animals may have lived a better life than had they been confined in a shed, but they still had to go through the experience of being slaughtered in an industrial slaughterhouse. Now, what some very, very small percentage of farmers do, again, smaller farmers, is they will bring what's called a mobile slaughterhouse unit to the farm. And this is essentially a slaughterhouse on wheels. And This is by far an improvement for the animals, because one of the most horrifying things of the entire slaughter experience for farm animals is the transportation. And so if you cram animals, particularly cows and pigs, into a truck and take them to a slaughterhouse, studies have shown that upwards of 20% will have broken bones at the end of that trip, getting just jostled around the back of a truck. Well, that stage, that link in the chain, is taken out when the slaughterhouse rolls up to the farm. The problem with this is scale. It's just very difficult for farmers to slaughter, particularly if we're talking about pigs or cows, more than a handful of animals a day, because these animals have to be slaughtered one at a time. Another concern actually is with sustainability of these mobile slaughterhouse units. One of the things that we're really concerned about today with our food system is waste. And if an industrial slaughterhouse has one benefit, it is that nothing gets wasted. I mean, every part of the animal gets rendered or dehydrated or packaged and sent somewhere in the world to meet some sort of consumer desire. This doesn't happen with mobile slaughterhouses. You have blood that's left over, you have offal that's left over, you've got a carcass that's left over, and the rules that are in place for disposing of these byproducts of slaughter are in many cases alarmingly slack. And so in some cases farmers can just let all this stuff pour into the soil or dig a hole and bury it. And so there are some clear sanitary issues that are raised when a slaughterhouse does come to the farm. Again, though, for the animal, it's a far better solution than having to travel a couple hundred miles to go to a slaughterhouse, but it's virtually impossible to see how the slaughter industry could be decentralized given the demand that currently exists for animal products. So it's a bit of a sideshow to the main story, which is business as usual in an industrial slaughterhouse, you know, even for these small farmers.
Would you just underscore and elaborate on why you think the small-scale, organic, free-range raising of animals is not a long-term strategy for reform of our food system to make it more humane?
Well, it can constantly be made more humane as a long-term strategy. I mean, it's certainly possible to raise animals in an environment in a way that is generally beneficial for that animal until, of course, the animal's untimely death. An untimely death, by the way, that usually comes about one-fifth of the way through an animal's natural life. I mean, that certainly is possible, and there are farms that I think quite admirably pursue that goal, but there's two things to consider. One is that you still face a very serious ethical issue of claiming to care so much about an animal that you will restructure your farm to accommodate that animal's interests while that animal is alive, and then on one day when that animal reaches a certain weight, killing that animal. That, you know, just ethically requires some sort of resolution, and I have yet to hear a satisfying answer to that conundrum. And that's one thing to consider. The second thing to consider is that, putting that ethical conundrum aside, farms that do pursue these really stringent welfare standards and farms that may indeed have the animals' interests at stake while those animals are alive are going to have to charge much more for the meat and the dairy and the eggs that they produce, because it is one of the most inescapable facts of animal agriculture that welfare is costly. It costs more to treat an animal well, and those costs get passed on, of course, to consumers. So what that means is that you create this kind of two-tiered food system, one tier very thin and only accessible by those who can afford to buy into it and feel good about themselves for supporting the, you know, the quote-unquote right kind of animal agriculture, leaving the rest of consumers to continue to buy the factory-farmed alternatives, which, as I mentioned earlier, will always be available. So the discussions that we have about these farms being so superior to the industrialized alternatives really need to be framed in this larger concern about accessibility and scalability. Otherwise, we're just looking at a radically bifurcated food system where only those with the most resources can choose to eat ethically.
What do you hope your book will accomplish?
The primary goal of the book, again, is to create greater scrutiny of the sources of our animal products, both on a large scale and a small scale. That's the kind of practical takeaway I'd like consumers to have. So if consumers are buying eggs at a farmer's market, I guess I'd like them to have more questions to ask their farmer when they go to buy those eggs. That's the practical takeaway, but I also, I guess more ambitiously, would be very pleased if consumers read the book and actually started to think about the underlying ethical implications of eating animals that we raise for food when we don't have to. Granted, there are cultures, there are societies where people still have to eat animal products for basic sustenance, but the people who read my book do have a choice, and I guess I would like to encourage readers to think about not just eating a certain kind of animal product or animal products from a certain kind of farm, but to maybe reconsider that choice and then consider giving up eating all domesticated animals, period. For what it's worth, I'm not actually thoroughly opposed to eating animals. It's going to sound kind of fringe-like and peripheral, but you know, I have written recently about the ethics of eating insects, and that's starting to actually get some attention, as well as, perhaps even more peripherally, the ethics of eating roadkill. You know, my big issue with domesticated animal agriculture is the choice to raise animals for the purposes of our consumption. It's the intention that really matters. So I would be very pleased if consumers really started to think about how that question of intentionality and how the whole idea of domesticated animal agriculture may very well corrupt us rather than just make us feel good.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I guess for those who choose to read the book, I worked very hard to write it in a way that it was not perceived as a threat to our pre-established habits. You know, eating meat is something that we don't think about because we're never asked to think about. So the takeaway message would be, even if we can start to think about the ethics of eating animals, then we're on the right track. And I think it's a track that will, in the long run, be better for humans as well as the animals that we now eat.
Well, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thanks so much for the good questions. I appreciate it.
You were just listening to James McWilliams, Ingram Professor of History at Texas State University and author of the book The Modern Savage, Our Unthinking Decision to Eat Animals, published in 2015 by Thomas Dunn Books. For more information, check on the web at james-mcwilliams.com. Again, that's james-mcwilliams.com. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the Sustainability segment again next week on Listener Powered 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.